This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Barbara Mancini, a Philadelphia-area nurse, has been charged with assisted suicide in the death of her 93-year-old father, Joe Yorshaw. He was getting hospice care in his home in Pottstown, growing weaker and dealing with the pain and discomfort of a number of serious ailments. According to news reports, Yorshaw asked his daughter for his morphine, which she gave him. He reportedly took a lethal dose, and when the hospice nurse arrived, Mancini told her what she had done. The police and paramedics were called. Yorshaw was revived in spite of a DNR, rushed to the hospital, and died 4 days later. His death certificate said he died as a result of homicide. This story has garnered national attention because of the legal, ethical, and personal questions it raises about end-of-life care and end-of-life decisions. Did Barbara Mancini give her father the morphine to help him die or to relieve his pain? It's our topic for today's Radio Times. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is David Casserette. He's an associate professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. He's also director of hospice and palliative care at the University of Pennsylvania Health System. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called Last Acts, and he's got a forthcoming book on the science of resuscitation called Shocked. And David Casserette, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks.
You're welcome. Also joining us by telephone is Thaddeus Pope, director of the Health Law Institute and an associate professor of law at Hamline University. And Thaddeus Pope, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
David, let me begin with you. And as someone who deals with and treats patients and families in these end-of-life situations, what sort of main question has this case raised for you?
There are really questions on two levels. Partly, I'm wondering what happened in this case. A lot of the facts are not clear. I'm wondering whether Joe Yorshaw actually requested assistance in dying. And if he did, and I'm not saying that's the case, we just don't know at this point, it's not clear. But if he did, I'm wondering why. Was it a fear of the future? Were there pain or other symptoms that could have been managed better? Was it loss of dignity or control? These are some of the reasons why people request aid in dying. So a lot of what I'm curious about and what I'd like to know is those sorts of factual issues right now.
And we're talking about a case that no three of us or any of our listeners really have unique or special knowledge of. So we're talking about something we really don't know much about. And yet, and I'm curious to you, David, and then to you, Thaddeus, this has become a national story. Why do you think all of us have sort of glommed on to this very sad story?
It is a very sad story, and yet it's a story that really hits a lot of keys for a lot of us. None of us really wants to think about dying. None of us wants to think about the loss of dignity and control and loss of function that often, but not always, often comes with advanced illness near the end of life. And many of us, when we think about assisted suicide, we think of that as the way out. That's the answer. It's easier to think about the ethics of assisted suicide. It's easier to think about what we would do in a circumstance like this than it is to think about all of the details and sometimes unpleasant facts of what it's like to grow old, to lose function, to face a serious illness. And certainly it's easier to think about assisted suicide than it is to think about advanced directives and living wills and conversations. It's both in terms of thinking and also to some degree in terms of policy. It seems like the easy way out. And so we think about this, we talk about it, we're energized by these sorts of questions when we ignore the bigger picture, which is a shame.
And I want to pick up on all of that. Thaddeus Pope, let me get you in on the conversation. As a lawyer, how do you view this case?
Well, first, we don't know that it really is properly characterized as an assisted suicide case. The police complaint and the autopsy report indicate that she told both the officer that arrived on the scene, and she also told the hospice nurse that she gave the morphine to her father because and for the purpose of hastening his death. So there's some evidence, two witnesses, for example, that suggest that this may properly be characterized as an assisted suicide case, but that evidence is, you know, still being developed. If it is properly characterized as an assisted suicide case, then the reason why I think it's getting all the attention is because many people think, well, if I were Joe Yorshaw, I would like to have that option, right? If my current, if I found my situation intolerable, I would want to have the ability to hasten my death, but yet the prospect of criminal sanctions being brought upon anybody who helped me would probably deprive me of that option. So I think that's why it raises the whole debate about whether or not this should be an available option for people.
Well, and I think what you're saying is sort of underscoring this question that hangs over this particular case. And I think anyone that has had to deal with a dying family member or dying loved one has to struggle with some version of this. This is back to you, Thaddeus Pope. So did she give her father the morphine to help him die or to relieve his pain? And we know that morphine can do both those things, right?
Right. That's another issue, and probably David could speak to this better, but that's another issue, because if she gave him the morphine solely to treat his pain, and that happened to coincidentally cause or hasten his death, then that's troublesome, right? Because this could be prosecuting somebody for doing that would chill proper pain control, right? It would be hospice, nurses, family members, others would be afraid of giving too much pain medication for fear that they would be the next Barbara Mancini. So that's a very dangerous chilling effect. So to be clear, it does look like at least the Attorney General's office does have evidence that her purpose was not to solely to treat his pain, and it just so happened that hastened his death. But it looks like they have evidence, and the reason for charging was because they have evidence that her intent in giving the morphine was to hasten his death.
Well, I'd be curious about this from a medical, I guess, ethics perspective. How do you see these two questions seem to hang out on this question?
Sure. I agree with Thaddeus that it's entirely appropriate to prescribe and use morphine or other opioids with the intention of relieving pain. If that hastens death, then that's an acceptable side effect. We prescribe drugs all the time that have side effects, and slowed respiration, sedation is one of the side effects that opioids have, just like all drugs have side effects. So that's entirely true. It's important for listeners to realize, though, that the risks of hastening death with the use of opioids like morphine is really, really very small and almost theoretical. If opioids are used in the right way for the right patients in the right doses to treat pain, meaning not for abuse, but right, to treat pain, the likelihood that those opioids used in the right way will hasten death are really, really very small. For the most part, opioids given to patients, say, with cancer-related pain, reduce that pain, sometimes even eliminate it entirely, make patients feel somewhat close to normal. But I've never had any of my patients take a prescription of opioid, like morphine, and tell me, I feel great. At most, it helps them to feel better.
But, you know, I know cases of people who have been dying and in a hospital on morphine, and with the hospital's knowledge and permission, that morphine has sort of helped them sort of complete and end their life. Are you saying that that's usual? Is that a common experience in a hospital setting, for instance?
I don't know how common it is. Certainly speaking from my experience in palliative care at the University of Pennsylvania, our physicians would use morphine to relieve symptoms. Mm-hmm. I would be very, very surprised if it were commonplace for physicians to use morphine to hasten the dying process.
Just because it doesn't work, or it's just that step too far?
If you use morphine or other opioids appropriately to treat pain, meaning somebody who's awake and alert but has severe pain, who takes a large dose of opioids, that would control the pain but would not put them to sleep. If that dose is escalated beyond that point, you begin to treat patients with particularly rapidly increasing doses of opioids, then yes, it is certainly possible to get respiratory suppression. But if your goal, back to Thaddeus's point, if your goal is not to treat the pain, if you exceed that threshold and you keep providing opioids, that certainly would create a risk of hastening death.
Well, and Thaddeus, if I can go back to you and the little that we know about this case, but our understanding, and reportedly, Barbara Mancini gave her father this bottle of morphine. She didn't administer it. She didn't, you know, force him to take it, as far as we understand. Is that, from a legal perspective, is that significant that she didn't intervene in that more sort of active, overt way?
Well, so the Pennsylvania statute that she's being charged under criminally prohibits both causing a suicide and, separately, in a separate section, aiding a suicide. So she's not being charged with causing a suicide, right, where she used force or duress or coercion, right, to give him the morphine against his will. So she merely assisted or aided him by giving him the morphine. So that's the section she's being charged under. And the allegations, going back to how David was framing this,
sure. Is
the bottle apparently was, I think, maybe a 60-milligram bottle, and it maybe only 5 or 10 had already been used. So I think, the evidence is still being developed, but the idea is that she gave him so much, or at least assisted him in injecting so much that, and since she is a nurse, the argument is that she knew better, right? And so therefore, again, in addition to the two, I'll call them quote-unquote confessions or admissions to the hospice nurse and to the arriving police officer, there's also this idea that she gave so much morphine that her intent must have been to hasten the death and not merely to control the pain.
David, we're about a minute away from our first break here, but I'd be curious, since you work with hospice patients, and I'm sure their families as well, what has been their reaction to this story?
I've been actually very concerned by reactions. This is maybe more of a discussion for after the break, but I'm very concerned at how this case is being perceived. I think I've certainly spoken with patients who are now reluctant to use hospice for fear that bringing a hospice nurse in would be essentially bringing an informer into their home. I've spoken with patients who have heard about the case who are now reluctant to use opioids for fear that they would get their families in trouble, and vice versa, families who are reluctant to allow patients to use opioids for exactly the same reason. So there's a lot of concern, I think, about this case, most of it hopefully out of proportion right. To what the real risks are. But those perceptions, whether they're legitimate or not, certainly run the risk of significant downstream consequences that hurt patients and families.
I want to pick up on all of that, and that's David Cassaret, our guest, two guests in this hour of Radio Times. He's an associate professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, also director of hospice and palliative care at the University of Pennsylvania Health System, and joining us by telephone, Thaddeus Pope, director of the Health Law Institute and an associate professor of law at Hamline University. Talking about this case you've probably heard about, a Philadelphia area nurse, Barbara Mancini, been charged with the assisted suicide of her 93-year-old father. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Longwood Gardens supports WHYY and presents fireworks and fountains shows. There are two more opportunities to come for the blooms and stay for the booms this season. Saturdays, August 31st and September 14th. On August 31st, fireworks and fountains light up the sky set to the classical music of Dmitri Shostakovich. On September 14th, fireworks launch to the iconic pop hits of Elton John. Limited tickets are available online at longwoodgardens.org.
Next time in Studio 360, we take the show live on stage with a tough crowd that gives even great performers the jitters.
Every time I get nervous, I start to talk really fast. Nobody can understand nothing I'm saying, which is very frustrating for me, as you can imagine.
Actress-writer Sarah Jones and singer-songwriter Steve Earle join us at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, Congressman John Lewis, the last living speaker from the 1963 March on Washington.
And then we start walking down Constitution Avenue. We saw hundreds and thousands of people already marching. It was almost like saying, there go my people. Let me catch up with them.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about a story that's generated a lot of attention because it raises a whole host of issues about decisions involving end-of-life care. A Philadelphia area nurse has been charged with the assisted suicide of her father, who was in hospice care because she handed him a bottle of morphine. Our guests are Thaddeus Pope, director of the Health Law Institute at Hamline University, and David Casserette, director of hospice and palliative care at the University of Pennsylvania Health System. And we're taking calls, particularly want to hear from those of you who have care or have cared for or are caring for a loved one, perhaps even dealing with some of these issues. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. That is, if I can go back to you and actually quote something from the U.S. Supreme Court, I think this was Sandra Day O'Connor, and the Supreme Court has ruled on a couple of cases involving, I guess, assisted suicide. She wrote, a patient who is suffering from a terminal illness and who is experiencing great pain has no legal barriers to obtaining medication from qualified physicians to alleviate that suffering, even to the point of causing unconsciousness and hastening death. The idea that you could be getting medication that, while it does relieve your suffering, also hastens your death, and that should not be unconstitutional. I don't know if I'm reading that correctly or not, but how significant is that ruling to our discussion?
Well, the ruling only basically restates what's already accepted law and policy and practice, which is something David was getting at earlier, which is, and it goes back all the way to Thomas Aquinas, is called the doctrine of double effect, which is, if your intent is to just control the pain, and that so happens to not just control the pain, but to also hasten death, then that's okay. We understand that that's a side effect, a double effect of treating pain. And if that happens, that's totally fine, because we want people to be able to treat their pain. So I don't think the Supreme Court ruling in and of itself, because that's what we would call dicta as far as that Supreme Court holding goes, but that's already the accepted law under Pennsylvania state law.
And we should say that there are, I think, four states now that have legalized assisted suicide. That would be Oregon, Washington, Vermont, and Montana. Do I have that right, Thaddeus Pope?
Right.
And where physicians can, I guess, intervene in a way that they can't intervene in a state like Pennsylvania?
Right. Well, so those states, Montana is a little bit different because there's just a Supreme Court ruling and basically says there isn't a legal obstacle. But at least in Washington, Vermont, and Oregon, they have a very thorough process that the patient and the physician can follow that sets forth all sorts of safeguards to assure that the patient's request for a lethal dose of medication is voluntary and informed, and this is a settled, deliberated wish. So those states have those processes set forth. We don't have a statute like that in Montana. But that's right. So the physicians in those states can prescribe a lethal dose of barbiturates. It's specifically authorized in a way that it's not in the rest of the states.
David, we're talking about someone who was in hospice care. That was Barbara Mancini's father. Apparently had many serious health conditions, heart problems and arthritis and diabetes. Apparently there was a DNR as well. And according to some NPR reporting, he had talked about, you know, not wanting to live or perhaps even wanting to die. As someone who deals with people in these really critical, heartbreaking situations, how do you sort of navigate between all these various issues?
It is difficult. One of the first things our hospice nurses do when they go out to see a patient with Penn's hospice is to find out what's going on with the family, what their needs are, what the patient's needs are, and how we can help. And often, an expression of a desire for hastened death, statements which I hear not infrequently, like, I don't know how much longer I can keep going, I can't keep going like this, I wish I could just end it, I think there's a temptation to hear those and to assume that's a statement of a preference, and sometimes it is. But often it's a conversation starter. Often it's, I hate to use the phrase, but it's a cry for help, or in more pedestrian terms, it's a signal that there's something else we need to talk about. And so when I hear that, my first reaction is not to assume that this is a person who wants assistance in dying, but this is a person who needs help in other ways. Mm-hmm. And that then is a cue for me and for our nurses and our social workers and our chaplains and our volunteers to begin to unpack what's going on. Is it fears about the future, or are there concerns about dignity and loss of control? Are there pain and other symptoms? What's going on that led to this? In other words, to treat that request almost, I don't mean to dismiss it, but it's almost a symptom. It's a cue for more conversation rather than a simple statement of preference.
And are you worried that this case becomes a conversation stopper, that because of this, people won't want to have this conversation?
I've been worried for a long time that we're much more enthusiastic and ready to talk about assisted suicide than we are to talk about advanced directives and living wills. You know, I think a lot of people out there who hear about this case and say, yeah, I would want the right to end my life, those people probably don't have living wills or advanced directives, because most people don't. Right. They probably haven't had conversations about what they would want with their family members, because most people don't have these conversations. So it's partly that it's a conversation stopper. It's also, in a way, a distraction. All the people right now who are listening to this program thinking about assisted suicide, I would much rather, honestly, that they turn to their family member sitting next to them and start talking about what kind of care they would want if they're no longer able to make decisions.
Thaddeus Bob, I'm curious about the DNR part of the story, the do not resuscitate part of the story. And I mean, how, from a legal perspective, how ironclad is that?
How ironclad is that?
Even beyond this particular circumstance, but just, I mean, people have DNRs, and whether they're complied with or not, I can't say. But what does that mean, I guess, legally?
Well, two things. One, I mean, DNR typically refers to just cardiopulmonary resuscitation. So it's not, you know, the whole gamut of possible medical interventions. But if your heart or inner breathing have stopped, are we going to restart it? And normally, if you have a DNR, then healthcare providers should not perform CPR on you, right? Because you requested that it not be performed on you. So generally, legally, that would be a battery, right, to perform CPR on somebody who has a DNR order. But in practice, it happens a lot. There's all sorts of exceptions. For example, if you're going to go in for surgery, normally it's suspended, operatively, postoperatively. So there's all sorts of exceptions to it. And in practice, it doesn't, they aren't always complied with.
What do you think, David?
I think Thaddeus is right. They're not always complied with. I would say probably 99% of the time they are, but sometimes they're not, and sometimes they really shouldn't be. When I was a resident, I was called for a code blue to take care of a patient who had choked on a roast beef sandwich. And the nurse who was in the room told us that, well, you can't resuscitate him. He has a DNR order. And the other resident and I looked at each other and did some quick calculations and thought, you know, when that patient agreed to that do not resuscitate order, he probably wasn't thinking about a fatal encounter with a roast beef sandwich. And so we resuscitated him, took him to the endoscopy suite, removed the offending piece of roast beef. He survived, went home, lived for another 2 years. Did we do the right thing? I don't know. But when you agree to a DNR order, it's really very, very broad. And I think we need to assume that at least some of the time we'll have to rely on healthcare providers, physicians, nurses to make some judgment calls, and hopefully we'll make those judgment calls appropriately.
That is just picking up on this notion of wills and advanced directives. Do you agree with Dave DeCasseret that while people may talk about someone else's situation, many people don't have an advanced directive or don't have a living will to help guide those who might be caring for them?
No, those statistics are well documented by many different government and private organizations, that most of us don't have advanced directives. And moreover, even those of us that do, they're normally either not available because we put them away in a drawer, and so when we lose capacity and we're admitted into the healthcare system, we can't find the advance directive. So we completed one, but it's not available. And even when we have completed them and they're available, they're often not useful in the sense that the language is so vague, like, no, I don't want any heroic measures. Well, what's a heroic measure under your circumstances? So at those three levels, not completing them, not making them available, and then they're not always written in a way that's particularly useful as guidance to the healthcare providers, means that they're not, you know, doing the job that, you know, we had once hoped that living wills and advance directives would do for us.
And that's Thaddeus Pope. He's director of the Health Law Institute at Hamline College. Also with us, David Casseret, director of hospice and palliative care at the University of Pennsylvania Health System, talking about a case here in the Philadelphia area. A Philadelphia area nurse has been charged with the assisted suicide of her father. He was in hospice care at home. She reportedly handed him a bottle of morphine, which he took. A hospice care nurse came to the house, discovered what had happened, called the police, called paramedics. The father was taken to a local hospital, resuscitated, and then died 4 days later. It's raised a whole host of questions about these end-of-life care decisions, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get to Brian from Northeast Philadelphia to join us. Brian, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Maureen, and thank you for this conversation
You're
today.
Welcome.
This issue touches home for me because my mom was put on hospice care earlier this year, and she passed away. Going into it, I had a totally, different view of hospice care than probably I was disillusioned. I thought it was the greatest thing. I had heard the nurses and the caregivers were wonderful. But having gone through it, I realized there was a lot of controversy, difference of opinion between the nurses and the caregivers, when to begin morphine, when not to, the setup. There was just so many different problems, even in the hospice care. Incidentally, we did have Penn Hospice. Not that it really matters, because I think the issue would have been with any hospice care. And I think all the documents you can have in advance really don't mean much until you're put in the situation. And the conversation I've had with people since is, when you get to that point and you see someone you love suffering, I kept saying, pump her with morphine. I just wanted to pump her. If it was up to me, I would have handed her the morphine and pumped it in her myself. So I know it's controversial, I know it's legal, but if it's a loved one, I don't see what's the point in it having, when you know death is imminent, why not? We have the treatments. Why are we letting them suffer? And my mom did suffer at the end. It was definitely not a beautiful, peaceful ending. And I think that was because everyone differed. Like, nurses would come in and say, no, we don't want to give that amount. Like, there was actually controversy about how much. It wasn't a smooth transition. So I think there's a lot of factors that go into this. I endorse the daughter, what she did, 100%, as do many of the people I've talked about. Even with the whole Terry Schiavo, I think, kind of brought the whole issue to the forefront. And I have a DNR and a DNI.
Oh, DNR and a DNI. No, I appreciate the call. You raise a lot of really good points, and I'm going to toss this first to you, David Casseret, and what he's describing in his particular situation was conflict between the hospice nurses, the family, maybe even between the hospice nurses about what to do. I mean, that's got to put enormous stress on a family and a patient.
Yeah, I think it puts enormous stress on everybody. So first of all, Brian, I'm sorry for your loss.
Yeah.
Hospice is in really a difficult position because we come into patient's care, family dynamics that have been going on for decades, relationships that a patient has with his or her physician that have been going on sometimes for years, and trying to coordinate, trying to organize, trying to get people on the same page, not simply with respect to opioids, but with other plans, where patients want to spend their final time, how they want to spend their final time. We really do try to get in there and coordinate fairly quickly, which is particularly difficult for many hospices like ours, affiliated with an academic health system. Half of our patients are referred to us in the last week of life. So everything that has to go on often has to go on very, very quickly.
But who calls the shots? I mean, are there rules that define under these circumstances who decides and if the patient can't decide for themselves?
If only it were that simple, that the decision is whether the patient can decide for him or herself. But many patients, again, many of our patients referred to us in the last week of life and are either awake and alert sometimes but not others, have varying degrees of decision-making capacity, and then family members have varying opinions. And to be fair, this is ethical territory that no matter how concrete we try to make it, nurses, physicians differ. So when we think about who decides, the logical answer to that question obviously is the patient. The patient really should decide.
What are your thoughts, Thaddeus?
Well, I mean, I don't know Brian's case, but he did seem to suggest that the nurses were in disagreement and not enough pain medication, in his opinion, was given. And I think that's what David was highlighting earlier, which is there is a potential chilling effect from this case. In particular, which is people may be chilled or scared off from giving what they might think to be the medically appropriate or indicated amount of pain medication because they don't want to be the next Barbara Mancini. And so that's the one dangerous thing about this Mancini case, is that perhaps some sort of guidelines or safe harbors need to be set forth to say don't worry, hospice nurses, so long as you do this, this, and this, and document it in this, and this, and this way, you're safe, right? Because otherwise, there's the chilling effect can expand.
But what I also hear, Thaddeus, from, and you're a lawyer, but this is a different kind of question, but I hear from Brian's story is that he saw it as a loving, caring thing to do to help his mother die. I don't know. Can the law deal with that?
If your intent is to, as it isn't alleged in the Barbara Mancini case, if your intent is to help your loved one die, then right now under Pennsylvania law that is a crime. So as of right now, the way the law deals with it is to criminalize it. Now, most of the time, this may happen, right, all the time, and normally either it doesn't get discovered or prosecutors just decide that not to pursue it, right? And in fact, in England, in the United Kingdom, for example, the prosecutorial guidelines are set forth, they're published in writing, to say, look, so long as we're sure that the patient made a voluntary, informed, and settled choice, and so long as we're sure that the family member was motivated by compassion as opposed to greed or something, then it's we're not going to touch it. We're not going to pursue it, right? So they have standards about when or not they will pursue these cases.
Well, that's
I think even though in the United States we don't have those sort of formalized guidelines, I think informally or in practice, most prosecutors use those same sort of guidelines.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Thaddeus Pope. Also with us, David Cassaret, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
The WHYY Connections Festival is back with a day of free live music featuring They Might Be Giants, Ben Queller, and more. Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza at Penn's Landing. The WHYY Connections Festival is free for everyone, and WHYY members and sustainers get exclusive access to the member oasis tent all day long. They Might Be Giants and more Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza. For a full lineup and to register, visit whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
On the next Fresh Air, hear about the internet company so determined to escape government regulation it took its servers to an abandoned fort in the North Sea. Nate Anderson tells that and other stories about authorities cracking child pornography sites, spam, and botnets, all arising from the freedom and anonymity of the online world. His book is The Internet Police. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Eric Holder's Justice Department thinks it can still challenge voting laws in the state of Texas. Some Texans have other ideas.
You all have heard about a straw man argument. This is a dead law argument.
Our guided tour of voting rights since the Supreme Court decision Shelby versus Holder begins in Texas. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking about a case here in the Philadelphia area in Pennsylvania. A Philadelphia area nurse named Barbara Mancini has been charged with the assisted suicide of her 93-year-old father after she handed him a bottle of morphine, according to reports. Her dad was found by a hospice nurse shortly after he took the pills, was given a drug despite of a do not resuscitate order. He died several days later in the hospital. There are some, of course, murky facts around this case, things we do not know, but it has raised a whole host of questions about some of these end-of-life care decisions. And talking about all of this with David Casaret, he's director of hospice and palliative care at the University of Pennsylvania Health System, has a forthcoming book about the science of resuscitation called Shocked. And Thaddeus Pope joining us by telephone, director of the Health Law Institute and an associate professor of law at Hamline University. Let me see what Dale from Bala Cynwyd has to say. Dale, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a nurse. And I also lost my mother to liver met from pancreatic cancer 3 years ago. I worked on a GYN oncology floor prior to that and was very familiar with hospice. And I have nothing but praise and admiration for the people who do this full time. I just want to say to the doctor from Penn that it was tacitly understood on our GYN oncology floor and told to us by our GYN oncologist that if someone was dying, actively dying, chain smoking, not swallowing, and you moved them and they moaned, you increased the morphine. Mm. You just kept increasing it until they stopped breathing. And the same thing was told to me by the hospice nurse while my mother was dying when she was on the morphine pump. Hit that pump as often as you want, it'll freeze out and then just keep hitting it. Because she was a very strong woman. She was 84 years old, but she had ridden 81 miles on her bicycle 2 months before she got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and lived for 3 years with it. So, you know, she had a very, very strong cardiovascular system. And I don't understand why people are so afraid of helping people die.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blessing and a gift to be part of that. I mean, my younger sister isn't a nurse, and she started crying when my mother died, and I was trying to comfort her, and she said, "No, I'm just so happy it's over." And for
Dale, only because we have so many callers, and I'm sorry about your mom, and you've raised such important questions that I want to give both of our guests a chance to respond to that. And David, I'd just be curious about your thoughts.
Well, Dale, I'm sorry to hear about your mother. I think related to your comments about what often happens in a hospital setting, we may be saying the same thing in two different ways, just to be clear. You mentioned the advice that was given about how to respond if a patient is moaning. Often near the end of life, that sort of moaning or agitated behavior or a flinching away if a patient is touched, often when patients are unable to talk, that's the only indication we have that a patient may be in pain. Mm-hmm. And so in those circumstances, certainly we would increase the dose of morphine or other opioids. To be clear, though, the reason we would do that and the reason that I've recommended doing that in the past is not to hasten death, but because we have a suspicion that this patient is uncomfortable and we need to act on that suspicion. I cannot say that what you described is rare. I wouldn't be surprised if it does happen. But in general, we use opioids to treat symptoms, not to hasten an exit.
Yeah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Thandi, if you could take that as well, because this is just anecdotal.
Yes.
The idea that this stuff is happening and happening not in malign ways, but benign ways, people trying to help someone have a good death. Go ahead.
Yes, so absolutely. We know there's been lots of reports in the medical literature, surveys, anonymous surveys among physicians and others that we know this happens a lot. So the question, which was why not allow this compassionate sort of help, I guess the response is that while most people are motivated in the ways that Dale and Brian had called in to discuss, there is abuse, right? We have a problem with elder abuse in the United States. We have cases. There's a case being prosecuted in Kansas City right now where a daughter had forged a DNR order, an advance directive for her father, in order to hasten his death, in order to inherit his estate. So I'm not saying that's a big, big problem, but it's out there, right? And so we do need to weed out the selfishly motivated hastenings of death with the compassionate ones. And so that's why I don't think we could just have a green light to say whenever this happens, police and others can't look into it. We need to weed out the good and the bad cases.
Dale, thanks for the call to Radio Times. David, it's interesting, the two callers that we've had on the air, they want to talk. They want to tell us their story. I mean, there seems to be this hunger to not just tell the story, but try to understand, did I do the right thing? How do you help a person that you love die a good death? And it seems like there is such a hunger for that kind of conversation.
There is, I think, probably for the reason that you said. It's a desire to talk. It's a desire to understand what we could have done to help.
Right.
Often being a caregiver for a loved one who's dying is one of the most powerless experiences we'll go through. There's some things that we can help with, other things that we can't. And ultimately, for many patients in hospice, this person is dying and there's nothing we can do as caregivers, as family members, to reverse that. And so we want to do something, anything. And I think to some degree, the desire of a lot of us looking at a loved one, wanting to help, takes the form of wanting to help them die out of the best of intentions. And sometimes maybe logically that's the best answer, but it really does come often from the sense of powerlessness, wanting to help. It's important to keep in mind, though, that there are many other things that caregivers can do, like advocating for better pain management. And thinking back to the story that Brian told us,
sure,
I'm very, very sympathetic with and understand his desire to hasten his mother's death. I think given the circumstances he described, that makes a lot of sense. But I would turn that around and say, another thing that maybe we could strive to do is to advocate for better pain management. In this case, it sounds like he couldn't have, but that's another goal. That's another way in which we can help.
Dale, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Evan from Wynwood has to say. And Evan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead, Evan.
I'm sorry, hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm a surgeon in the Philadelphia area, and I just wanted to make one comment about the DNR status, the do not resuscitate status that was talked about earlier. From my perspective, and whether this is intentional or not, I think that sometimes in an acute care setting, not hospice, that the DNR status sometimes changes the level of care, maybe not on purpose, but I think sometimes the care is a little bit less. And so I encourage my patients and their families to be a little cautious about making a patient DNR until they're really kind of certain at that point, because I think sometimes the level of care goes down just a little bit, whether it's on purpose or not. So I just wanted to hear the guest's thoughts on that.
Evan,
and I think that roast beef story kind of suggested that a little bit as well.
Indeed. Thanks, Evan, for the call to Radio Times. Thaddeus Pope, can I toss that first to you?
Yeah, Evan's absolutely right. There's a researcher, Dr. Mariachi, who's up actually in Erie, Pennsylvania, who's done this sort of research that physicians, clinicians misinterpret the DNR. Like I said, it's supposed to be limited just to CPR, but it's often interpreted by clinicians to mean, you know, overall, broadly, just less aggressive treatment overall. And so I guess what Evan is highlighting is there's a danger that your DNR could be misinterpreted more broadly than you intended. And in fact, the survey evidence confirms what Evan is highlighting.
Mm, what do you think, David?
I agree. I, to be honest, I'm not sure how much of an effect it is. And to some degree, I think some patients who do choose a DNR order in the hospital actually choose it with that goal in mind. They do want less treatment. I think It's a single order that's supposed to encapsulate all of a patient's preferences. The idea that you could take all of my preferences about what treatments I want and don't want under various circumstances and dichotomize it as a do not resuscitate order, yes or no, seems silly. But that's often what we have to work with.
Evan, thanks for the call. Let's see what Morgan from Pennsylvania has to say. And Morgan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I'm a stage 4 cancer patient.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear
I'm
that.
I'm in palliative care with 10. I'm not in hospice yet, but I'm looking, you know, down the road. And my husband and I have talked about moving to a state where assisted suicide is legal because I would not want to get him in trouble, and I would not want to have a bad death. And I just think it's criminal that we don't legalize this in all different states. Our son died as a young man of cancer, and at the end he couldn't speak. He did get one sentence out, which was, help me.
Oh.
And the hospice nurse said, there's a bottle of morphine in the refrigerator. You can give as much as he needs for pain. But none of the family members could bring themselves to do that. So he lingered and lingered and lingered. And I just think it's an awful situation. I don't want to move because my community is here. I have excellent medical care. My doctor's great. But I'm looking ahead and trying to make a wise plan. Thanks.
Well, Morgan, first of all, thank you for the call to Radio Times. And, of course, we're sorry to hear about your situation and what happened with your son. How are you feeling? You said you're in stage 4 cancer.
I have stage 4 cancer that won't ever be cured. And right now I'm on different trial drugs. When if this next one doesn't work, then I don't know what the alternatives are. So I'm sort of in a state of uncertainty, I'd say.
Yeah,
I don't have a lot of pain right now.
Well,
that could change very quickly because I see that with other women who have gone down this road.
Well, again, I thank you for your call. You've raised so many important points. And David Kessler, let me just start with you. She's getting excellent care. She's in stage 4 cancer. She's not feeling pain yet. But she's thinking about how she wants to die and where she wants to die.
So I'm sorry to hear about both your history and what's going on now. You know, I wish I could promise that whatever the future has in store for you would be painless, would allow you to keep whatever dignity you want, would let you stay at home with your family without burdening family. I wish I could promise all of those things, but I can't. And I never promise my patients what I can't deliver. What I do promise my patients is that I'll stay with them, I'll work with them, and we'll take each day as it comes. And I think that's part of the problem, that we can't promise a painful, dignified death to everyone. We certainly can't promise that everyone will die on their own terms. And that's why this assisted suicide option is so attractive, because it's a way of taking away some of that uncertainty. I wish we as a society could promise that, both in terms of science and medicine and social support. And maybe 10, 20 years from now, we will be able to. But until then, comments like yours and a desire for assisted suicide like yours, I think is something that's going to be hard to get away from.
Yeah, terrible choice. Go ahead, Thaddeus Pope.
Well, I would just highlight exactly what Dr. Kasserat just said, which is I think what is really desired is control and comfort, knowing that you're having the control. Right? In the data from Oregon, where I think there's been over 1,000 requests, only 700 of the people who got the medication actually took it, because the key benefit is in knowing that it's there if you need it. And I agree with Morgan that it's to have that sort of knowing, have that, to get that comfort, she feels like she may have to move to Oregon, Washington, or Vermont, right, away from her family. So that's a bad choice to have to make.
Indeed. Morgan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and we wish you, of course, the best of luck as well. Luck is not exactly the right word, but we're so sorry for your situation. Thaddeus, this is sort of a jarring question here, but how often do cases like this, you know, end up in a court?
Well, when you say cases like this, they're assisted people being prosecuted under an assisted suicide statute. That happens all the time. Now, right, you have to distinguish between one teenager shooting another teenager or something like that versus the situations where it's an assisted suicide prosecution of a terminally ill patient. But there even are those, right? So there's those. It's not irregular. Probably, you know, monthly, maybe across the United States, or maybe a little bit less than monthly. But there definitely are cases. They're not all prosecuted all the way to a conviction, but at least there people are charged. It happens regularly.
Yeah. And David, we're almost out of time. Any thoughts you want to leave us with? I mean, this is such a poignant issue to talk about.
Yeah, my thoughts go out to Barbara and her family. You know, this is a national media event. We're all talking about it in academic terms, and yet there's this woman who has lost her father and now is facing criminal charges. And no matter what happens to patients down the road, no matter what gets decided, I think she and her family are in for a really, really difficult ride over the next 6 months, and I wish them all the best.
Indeed. Well, David Kesseret, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Yeah, and Thaddeus Pope, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, buddy.
You're welcome. Thaddeus Pope, director of the Health Law Institute, also an associate professor of law at Hamline University. David Kesseret is an associate professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, also director of hospice and palliative care at the University of Pennsylvania Health System. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called Last Acts, and a forthcoming book on the science of resuscitation is going to be called Shocked. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder with Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for those phone calls as well.